This is take number two of the morning of September the 16th. We're ready to go ahead, Mr. President.
The thing we're trying to get at, that there is a certain point of view, there's a certain capacity to sense as well as to record, and history does deal with these evaluations on a sensing basis. Well, how can a qualified researcher who will go to all the source material arrive at conclusions that aren't of a pedantic nature rather than a top scale basis that involves a major operation? In other words, how can a mere little professor mark the paper of a president without presuming?
It'd be very difficult for him to do it. There are people, though, who are capable of doing it if they have an inordinate desire to work hard and to search all the records. And very few of them have the time or the inclination to do that. So that's the reason we, if we're trying to get at the facts, have to get all the information we possibly can on the subject from every point of view.
But in this particular case, Mr. President, in this particular history that you're doing, what you're attempting to do is not necessarily state all the facts, but to evaluate certain tendencies and forces and outlooks of the American nation and the American people as you note them from your experience, and you have the experience certainly beyond anything that any professor at a college could have or any ordinary historian.
That's true, Bill, and we want to make the best use of it that we possibly can to be sure that we give an idea and a slant to the men who were presidents of the United States. It's a little different one from what they've had by the regular historians. Well, you can take one specific instance of what happens to sometimes great historians. You take the Beards. They're considered very great historians, and they became violently prejudiced against one of the presidents of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt. And the last volumes of the Beard's historical documents were written on a violently prejudiced basis and no longer good history.
Well then, can we arrive at some definition of what is history?
History is a record of events as they take place.
An accurate record.
Yeah, but, yes, the word accurate.
Is it necessarily that? Because the president just saying that there's a viewpoint too about what the record means.
Well, it's a record of events that take place and an attempt at an accurate record of events that take place, but it must also include the record of the personality of the person who caused those events to take place or who met them as the events came along.
Well, then it's a study in hindsight.
That's all it is.
All right, now we're having quite a problem with a very, very touchy subject right now, the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima.
That's right.
Here we're currently going through the thing, and yet the actions that were involved and the steps and conclusions that took place when you were making that decision are being completely distorted by even the major participants in that decision right now.
Well, they're being distorted for a purpose, for a political purpose. The actual facts have been stated as to what took place and why it was necessary that the bomb be dropped. Reasonable men have come to that same conclusion. Those men who want to discredit an administration or somebody who had control of the operations at that time can distort the facts. But I think we have the record pretty well cleared up on that, and when the actual facts can be assembled and have been.
Well, Bill, you got a point.
Well, Mr. President, in looking over, and I think what Dave has in mind is this U.S. News summary.
Among other things, yeah.
Among other things, but you will note that the evidence critical of your step is mainly that of very minor officials who may at a certain time have written out a memorandum to somebody in connection with the whole enterprise saying they didn't think it was wise to throw the bomb. But that is what I have in mind.
This includes the judgment of top scientists, too, don't forget.
No, very few scientists. Was a very small group of all and major scientists who supported the throwing. What I'm trying to emphasize is that here is an opinion of people who, looking back over a period, have taken rather small and minor objections which were raised at the time to make it appear as if they were major objections at the time.
There was only one group that had the viewpoint of the whole operation, And that group consisted of the President as Commander-in-Chief. It consisted of the Secretary of State and the Secretary of War and the Secretary of the Navy at that time, whose judgments of what had to be done and what was anticipated to be done were the judgments on which the decision to end the war was made, and that was to drop the bomb and end the war, and that's what happened.
Well, now, how are the future generations in Japan, the little kids in Japan who are going to go to school, going to get an idea of what a certain president of the United States, and whose power it was to make that decision, what kind of a person was he to do a thing like that?
Well, they won't ever have the right attitude on it, and I wouldn't blame them for that. That situation has been met to some extent by the cause of the difficulty between, you know, the war between Japan and the United States was brought on by the Japs themselves. They attained their objective in the beginning by taking over all the Western Pacific governments that they could get to, but they paid the bill when the final windup of the thing came, and we're always sorry, and you find that there are a great many Japanese, and I've been in correspondence with some of them, always say that had not the military been in control of the Japanese government at the time of the Pearl Harbor event, there had never been a war between the United States and Japan, because they'd always been friends.
Well, Dave's question was primarily framed to repeat the sort of thing that you get from critics and from people who say this was a horrible thing to do. They're not talking in hindsight. They all omit the fact that saturation bombing in Japan took fiercer tolls and wrought more havoc.
Far and away. The firebombing of Tokyo was one of the most terrible things that ever happened, and that didn't cause the surrender. They didn't surrender after the firebombing of Tokyo, although it was almost completely destroyed. But after this other event took place, then they were perfectly willing to surrender. They wouldn't surrender before. And one of the events that of that period was that some of these people who get exceedingly wrought up whenever we're in a war, who wanted to try the emperor and take him out as the head of the government of Japan. That had been done, the surrender would never have been completed because there were 1.5 million men and Japs on the Asiatic continent that never would have surrendered if the emperor hadn't told them to.
Well, what we're getting at now is a very key element in this whole picture of history. What they call history isn't necessarily so, and what passes for history isn't a fact or history. And we've used this illustration of the bombing of Hiroshima as a case in point.
That's correct.
That unless it comes from the source that made the decision, the motivation for the action cannot be properly assessed by those who, in hindsight, try to assess it with a lot of other irrelevant things that have nothing to do with the purpose or the judgment.
And they put actions and thoughts into the... They put the actions and the thoughts of those who had to make the decision in a different, entirely different light from what the facts really were. He once, shining instance, they said that I suggested to Stalin that he postpone the Japanese effort to get an approach through the Moscow government because we wanted to drop the bomb. We didn't anything of the kind because the bomb hadn't come to a conclusion at that time. They didn't know whether to go off or not.
Well, now, that is a fabricated falsehood based upon the recollection of one of the key men there.
That's right. And he didn't know what he was talking
about. Chet Boland, and he didn't put it in his original report,
No. But
he found some scraps of notes, and out of it he reconstructed something that you know didn't take place
at all.
Well, may I just add this, Dave, that even taking the belated recollection of Chip Boland and reading what he wrote down, his interpretation is not as damaging as the people who commented about his last notes, because they drew the conclusion that the peace talks with Japan were postponed in order to be enabled to throw the bomb. But Chip Boland doesn't indicate that at all.
No, he doesn't, but he leaves the door open for these people to walk
through.
Well, here's
another thing now, while I'm sort of fresh, I'll forget it. No one had any way of knowing what the Japanese were going to discuss with the Russians. Their effort entirely was to keep the Russians out of the war. It didn't have anything to do with their making peace.
Now, when you get to that point, it opens up a facet of judgment again that makes it pretty difficult to follow, because every scientist today that you talk to, every historian, Bill and I have talked to a bunch of them, takes a very prejudiced position on the testing of the bomb, the using of the bomb, the whole subject of the atomic bomb, and they're making a long record. And you would not find any objectivity in that field.
Not there.
Well, this is a small group you're talking about.
These are the people who are writing history. These are people who are making the
record. They're writing alleged comments, Dave. That's what I'm trying to get at. They're not writing history. They're writing their opinion of what happened.
Oh, well, it'll be taken as history. Oh, yes. Something is done show what the facts
That's
are.
Right.
Now what we're trying to get at is that history as such has been distorted, and it's been loaded down with a great many misjudgments and false facts, or no facts. And what we're trying to do here is to see whether we can't make history not only more palatable and more readily digestible and assimilable by both the students and the adults, but to give them a reappraisal or a new judgment of history in terms of your experience as president, and that puts the whole history in a new perspective. We can make the greatest possible contribution, both to historians as well as to students, if we redirect their judgments and their values in terms of not only the new facts, but a very important dimension, which is your experience, and how in light of that experience these facts appear to you. And you're entitled to a major reassessment of the combined judgments of history going to the pre-revolutionary days, right on, accepting you have to minor in your own. This is where
That's where we are in position to make comparisons in the administrations of other presidents as to the reports that we have on those presidents who, in some cases, were not able to leave a record of their own except the official papers with which they transacted the business of the government. We can put some new light on some of the historical statements that have been made about some of the great presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and several others, if we compare it with what's actually happened in their own experience of the president that's already alive.
Well, you attach a lot of importance to the personality of the man who's involved in history.
Yeah, very much so.
Can you...
Well, because you take two men and give them the same operation to carry through. One of them will know how to do it and go ahead and do it, and the other will be a failure and you'll have to take him out. That's happened all the way through the history of the world. Now, had not Julius Caesar and Cicero left their great writings for the posterity, I don't think we'd have ever had a chance to find out just how great those two men were in their period. They're the best examples I know of men who left a record. Cicero in his orations, Caesar in his commentaries, gives us a very different viewpoint that we would have had had we depended entirely on the historians of that day. They compare those things with what the historians have to say they think took place in Gaul, and they think took place in Rome when Cicero was one of the consuls. But when you read the facts from the men who made that history, you come to a different conclusion.
President, this is the end of tape number 2 of the morning of September 16th. This is tape number 3, the morning of September the 16th in New York. President,
I was going to get to the real value of history. Is it a way of teaching by example to those who are engaged in the conduct of affairs of people? Where does the value of history come, and has it been value to non-students or even students who were guided by the record?
Well, the way history generally has been taught, at least when I was growing up and going to school, it has always been made a very dry subject in dates and the happenings and things of that sort, instead of being made alive by showing how that event took place and who caused it to take place and what the results were after it did take place. That's the objective that I have in mind, is to try to put some life into the events which took place while the administration of Franklin Roosevelt and myself was going on.
In other words, you don't want this to be merely a collection of statistics and dates, et cetera, but you want to put some dimensions into history.
That's good.
What influenced you in reaching that sort of outlook?
This is my study of history. I've been studying history ever since I was 10 years old. Always was interested in what took place, and I've read everything I get my hands on the subject, and there were certain documents that put the men in the events in an interesting way. And when you run across one of them, it's better than reading any kind of a story you want, because those are events that actually happened and took place by some men taking a hand in it.
And
it wasn't the imagination of some novelist or something of that kind.
And you always feel that if you cloak an individual with the events, that people understand the events better.
Far and away better. Far and away better. Much more interesting, and it's the facts, the way they happen.
Well, as we understood you, you were going to take some of the cloaks off these demigods or individuals that have been deified by historians,
yes.
And you're going to bring them up to human proportions, and thus elevating them to where they can be seen and understood.
Which will make greater men out of them.
Very good. Now, the object of history, though, isn't, again, historically speaking, in parentheses, giving any special account of itself in terms of other people's, other leaders' behavior pattern. In other words, as you look through history, no one leader seems to have profited by the misfortunes and catastrophes of, say, a whole succession of dictators. Hitler certainly didn't learn from it. Mussolini didn't learn from it. The Russian dictators haven't learned from it. Is it because they don't take history seriously, or that they think it doesn't apply to them?
The reason, I think, for the difficulties of Mussolini and Hitler were that both of them were half-baked. Neither one of them was a historian, although each one thought he knew all there was to know about Roman history and German history. And that was one of the causes of their failures. They didn't go deep enough into the thing to see what happened to the dictators of history after the fact that when they had the countries under their control, nearly every one of them came to a bad end.
Well, isn't there a theory that there are certain cycles in history in which you go through a sort of republic or democracy, and then there's a breakdown, then there's dictatorship, and then it leads to something? Do you believe in cycles in history?
Yes, there are. There are cycles in history. People get tired, particularly if they get prosperous. They get tired of a certain regime, and they think they ought to have a change, and they think they did it themselves, and they don't understand what that regime has done for them. That's true in all history. There's only one great dictator whose succession lasted about four generations, and that was Genghis Khan in China. He set up a regime in that country, and there were several great emperors followed him. His grandson, for instance, the great Kublai Khan, was one of them.
Well, these were not exactly benevolent despots, were they? They were cruel and completely ruthless.
Oh, in their operations in a military way they were, but they were men who helped to build up their country. They had the welfare of their country at heart. And these conquests which they made, they used for the benefit of the Chinese people. That's the difference in most of them.
Well, that's not necessarily a laudable undertaking, though, is it?
No, it wasn't that day, though. It was something unusual.
Well, don't you often find that in the recording of history in the past, so much attention has been paid to men and events that not enough has been told of the background of these events. We know little about how people lived, the poverty or the riches they went through.
That's true, that's true.
The slavery or the freedom they had. And is that one of the troubles with the past recorded history that doesn't give you a proper balance or
that's
proper
true.
Picture?
The French Revolution was brought on by the great dictator, King Louis XIV. He left the country in a shape that caused the people to rise up and rebel because they didn't have enough to eat or enough to wear. And that's happened in a great many instances in the history of the country. That's one of the things that caused Mussolini to be able to obtain power. And the Italian people were in poverty and were ready for a rising. And he, in the beginning, he made a very good contribution to the recovery of Italy. But then the power went to his head, as in a great many instances, and he finally wound up hanging by his heels and his head cut off.
Well, all of this proves that governments have been imposed on peoples, that peoples didn't necessarily work out their own solution. The solution had to come from a person or from a particular group of people.
That's true. That's true.
Now, if you get into this area, then again, to get back to the how do we make history function so that the period of the resort to trial and error by leaders doesn't discount the results of history? And do you recall, in that sense, any contemporary president who was guided by a certain act in history in terms of repeating that same act but doing it better?
Woodrow Wilson's the most outstanding one. You see, the greatest of the great kings of France, King Henry IV, was the one who had the idea of a Congress of Europe which would keep the peace. He was on his way to put that into effect when he was assassinated. And then it all went to pot and was never thought of anymore until Woodrow Wilson came along with his idea that the governments of the world should have an association in which they could discuss their difficulties and not have to shoot each other to come to a good conclusion. And of course, that was defeated by the isolationists in the Senate of the United States. And then another effort has been made by Franklin Roosevelt when he set up the United Nations, and it has functioned very well up to date, but it's very young and it takes a long time for those things to be implemented. Our own Constitution had to go through the great many difficulties for over 80 years, and then we had to have a fight among ourselves for 4 years before we made up our minds we really wanted to work.
Well, is it your opinion that had we joined the League of Nations at that time, that the League of Nations would have survived and that we could have prevented? There's a lot of speculation about it. Do you really believe we could have prevented the Second World War?
I always have thought so. I've always thought so, that the very fact that we were not in the League of Nations, the greatest free government then and now in the history of the world, our standing on one side is one of the causes of the Hitler and Mussolini, which brought on the Second World War.
Could you develop that a little further, please, just to indicate what went wrong? How did we... is that the only reason why the League of Nations didn't survive?
Oh, no, that's not the only reason, but some of the things that happened in the League of Nations, I think, could have been very well worked out and settled had the United States been there speaking for free governments of the world. Of course, the European powers, which entirely made up the League of Nations, Japan didn't take much interest in it because Japan was on the road to do what she did in the Second World War. But the outside influence of an objective viewpoint from the Western Hemisphere, I think, would have been the survival of the League of Nations.
Well, we've just discussed the fact that the question was raised, how can we benefit from what has happened in history? Isn't the Constitution an example of taking advantage of what has happened in the past history and setting up a pattern for behavior for the future?
That's true. I want to say right here that I think the men, young men they were, who made up the Constitutional Convention, there were only two old men in it, they're comparatively old, that's Benjamin Franklin and George Washington. The others were all young men, and they were better educated in the history of government than any other association of men that's ever been together, and that's the reason they came out with a document that finally turned out to work well.
And therefore, that is an example in which history can help to work out the future.
That's right. Those men were trying to take advantage of the mistakes of previous governments in the history of the world. They could go all the way back. Those men were familiar with ancient and modern history all the way through.
And your example of Woodrow Wilson
Grand Plan of King Henry IV.
That's right. And the experience which arose out of that enabled Franklin Roosevelt and yourself to go one step further in the making of the United Nations.
We hope so. We're hoping for that.
Well, how did FDR, for instance, profit by the misfortunes or misjudgments of Woodrow Wilson?
He profited in this way, that when it came time to close up the Second World War and bring it to a conclusion, he had the advice of all sections of opinion in the United States. He had what we've named the bipartisan foreign policy, which included every party, the two great parties in the United States, all were both represented in a concrete way. Wilson didn't do that. He didn't have a bipartisan representation. He had a Republican or two with him in Paris, but they were Wilson Republicans. They were not the members of the actual Republican Party who ran that party. And of course, when Lodge and all the 13 senators who went along with him began their propaganda against Wilson personally, which is what it was. And the defeat of the United Nations, the defeat of the League of Nations, they simply continued the old isolationist policy set out by Washington when he had 3 million people, when he said that we ought to be involved in European affairs. Of course, in that day, it was a long way to Europe, and we were defended by two oceans, which were hard to navigate, the Pacific and the Atlantic. And that's created the idea of an isolationist Western Hemisphere and brought about the Monroe Doctrine for the establishment of hemisphere. Well, of course, that condition is entirely passed away. The Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean are no longer defense barriers. You can cross either one of them now in less than 3 or 4 hours. And it's going to be so we can cross them quicker. And the communication is instantaneous. We can talk to London, Paris, Moscow, Peking, or anywhere else in the world just like that. Doesn't take any longer than that to get hooked up, talk to them. And that means that we know what goes on in every section of the world, and it's drawn up from the size of a 30-inch globe to the size of an orange now in size, and what the communications and transportation, that's what the difficulty is.
Well, that division, in that sense, modern and ancient history, is pretty well obsolete in terms of being any guide to this new, smaller world tied together by communications and tending in another direction. How do you see that?
Parallel. It's just exactly like it is. Not exactly like it is. No institution with the great global empire, which by communication and transportation knit the whole Mediterranean bowl into one great empire. And as long as the Romans themselves were interested in the maintenance of a government that let that whole situation operate, they had no trouble. When they got lazy and fat, as I said a while ago, and thought that they, for them, instead of fighting for it themselves, down it went. The world now is in that same condition. This whole world now, with the United Nations base background, to transact the business of the world, just as we transact the business in the state of Missouri with 114 counties, every one of those counties, they should sit in the center of the government of the state of Missouri. Every one of the 50 states, they dare absolutely do everything, but they can't. It takes a federal government with the power to act for the benefit of the whole people, and this United Nations things, I hope, will come out. These things, I hope, will come out set on the center.
This is the morning of September 6th, on in a moment, President. The morning of September 6th, on in a moment.